Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another one of these updates on the ongoing situation involving Iran after America's attack. Now, yesterday, I talked about some of the retaliatory measures that Iran has taken. One of the things it started to do, which is a little bit interesting, or a lot interesting, and a little bit worrying, it has to be said, is that as well as hitting these hotels and American bases in these Gulf states like Oman and Dubai and Abu Dhabi and Saudi Arabia, you know, all the different Arab states there, it has also started to hit energy production, oil tankers, and various other things. It is basically punishing these Arab states for being American collaborators and saying things like, look, if you want this to stop, you kick the Americans out of the country. Otherwise, we're going to keep on coming. We're going to keep on coming. One of the very interesting things that they've done is they're targeting the energy output and they're attacking the actual economic interests of these countries. Now, as I'm recording this, Qatar, or Qatar, depending on where you're from, has literally cut all gas output. And it has sent the global gas price rocketing up 50%. That is a 50% increase in gas energy prices in a single day, in one day. Now, maybe that will change by the time you watch this. Maybe they'll turn it back on. But as things stand, as I'm recording this, they have stopped it and it's caused a 50% increase. The reason for that is because Qatar is not just a provider of gas, it is like the one of the number one producers. So I've enlisted the aid of a Black Horse finance bro extraordinaire, Canadian. You know, he knows a lot about markets. He's going to look at the oil side of this. He's going to have a look at the existing trends and what the current conflict might mean for that. But I find it extremely interesting that Iran is kind of going for it. It's kind of, you know, I talked yesterday about this chap, Larijani. Well, maybe the Ayatollah was fighting with one arm tied behind his back. Larijani seems to have taken the gloves off, and he's prepared to power game this situation. And I didn't really see them going for this. I think in their overwhelming focus on Israel, the Americans perhaps took the security of the Gulf states somewhat for granted. And now Iran is just hitting them and kind of letting them know what's what. Also quite embarrassing for the Americans, because the idea is that these Gulf states and the kind of corrupt regimes and the royal families that are kept in place, artificially propped up as American puppets, you know, they're meant to get something from the quid pro quo arrangement, i.e. America props them up and they get to have bases in the country. But in return, those bases and the American military is meant to be able to defend those Gulf countries should something like this happen. Well, they haven't been there. America has let down its security obligations to all of these Gulf countries. So, like, what is the point of all the bases if they can't defend themselves? Question to be asked. But before we get going here, I will remind everybody, Foundations of Shakespeare is now out, or it's going to be out, released very shortly, end of this week. Do pick it up. Oh, some noise there, but do pick this up. It's a fantastic volume. If you have bought the course, you can send the publishers a receipt, and you will get 50% off the retail price. A very, very good offer. We look fantastic on your shelf. Stocks are limited. I'm told that it's already 60% sold out. By the time it will probably be a lot more since yesterday's video, I'd imagine a lot more will have gone. So if you do want a copy of it, you know, I think once they're gone, they're gone. So do pick that up. Pick up other courses, Trivium, Foundations of Shakespeare, Foundations of Politics, Economics, and all the other things. One of the neat ways to get them all is to pick up something called the Mega Bundle, where a lot, I don't think Shakespeare's in there, but all the other ones are in there. With all of that said, if you want, like, we're going to really get down into the weeds and the nitty-gritty of the international oil market now. I don't have the expertise to talk to that. I need someone like Black Horse to come in. So I'm going to hand over to Black Horse, who will take us away for the rest of this video, where we actually have a look. I hope that the gas situation resolves itself, because this is going to directly affect people all across Europe. You know, it's going to, you know, thankfully, the sun has come out. The sun has come out here, which means that we're over the worst of the winter, which means we may not need as much gas. You know, a 50% increase is a pretty massive price spike in one day. And this, of course, is what Iran is going to do. It's going to hit supply lines. It's going to hit energy. It's going to really try to hurt the American empire where it really hurts, and grab these Gulf states by the balls, basically, until they squeal a little bit. Very interesting gamble, you could say. I mean, it's not, it's not necessarily how I would have played this, but, you know, like I said, Larijani ain't playing by the looks of things. Anyway, I'm going to hand over to Black Horse now. Catch you later, folks.
In 1973, in retaliation for American support for Israel during the Yom Kippur War, the Arab nations organized an embargo on the export of oil and gas from the Persian Gulf to the United States and to many of its allies. At the time, the Middle East represented about 37% of production of oil globally, and the embargo was catastrophic in the Western world. It created gas rationing, shortages of heating oil, massive price increases, inflation, broad economic disruption throughout the Western world, in Europe and in America. Now, in the long American political tradition, as this complex history of broken diplomatic relations unfolded, the American government attempted to pass off the disruption as not a consequence of their foreign policy, but a consequence of the decline of oil supply inherently, and as a kind of environmental problem. Let's listen to Jimmy Carter making his case here.
Good evening. Tonight I want to have an unpleasant talk with you about a problem that's unprecedented in our history. With the exception of preventing war, this is the greatest challenge that our country will face during our lifetime. The energy crisis has not yet overwhelmed us, but it will if we do not act quickly.
And so, whether it was Carter or Nixon before him, rationing was enforced using one justification or another in order to try to deal with the shock. And make no mistake, the shock was severe. In real terms, that is not adjusted for, that is adjusted for inflation, prices for oil increased by a factor of a little over six as a consequence of the disruption. In nominal terms, the shock was substantially more severe than that, because, of course, increased oil prices are near the beginning of the supply chain, and they echo through all of the other industries that depend on oil for their productive capacity. The shock was lasting from 1973 until the mid-80s. And the shock was resolved through three mechanisms: the restoration of production and production in the Gulf region. In other words, diplomatic tensions eased, and the Persian Gulf exporting countries began to deliver oil once again. The second was demand destruction through a combination of legislative fiat and through the natural market response to elevated prices. But the extent of the shock should note to us that the oil market is extremely inelastic, requires a lot of price movement to destroy any demand for oil. It's not a very substitutable product. And then the third element of the alleviation of the situation was the development of alternative resources. During this period, there's a lot of oil exploration and investment made in places like Canada and Latin America, also in Europe. And the history here is kind of interesting because when the political situation resolved in the Middle East, a lot of these investments, a lot of the investors who actually engaged in this development lost a great deal of money because the price of oil returned to levels reflecting the actual supply situation rather than the artificially constrained supply situation, and the most expensive producers were left holding the bag. So that's an important piece of history, and it is well remembered in the investment community surrounding future responses to crises. It's worth noting here that the price of oil eventually recovered again as a result in a change of a change in U.S. foreign policy with the Iraq War, which precipitated a smaller but significant disruption in the oil market. As I record this video, the Iranian government has begun to pursue a policy intended to restrict transit of the Straits of Hormuz. It is unclear exactly how effective, complete this disruption will be. The situation is certainly still unfolding. However, this video is not primarily going to concern itself with the political and military situation as it evolves in the region. There are people, you can go and read people who have greater expertise in this area than I do. However, there are a couple of things that must be noted off the top. The first is that the Iranians have very clearly demonstrated the ability to attack targets throughout the region, not just within the Straits. So, there's about 2 million barrels a day of pipeline capacity to route around the Straits. I would assume that if Iran is interested in restricting supply through the Straits, it's also interested in potentially attacking that capacity. Equally, some products like liquefied natural gas can be exported from the other sides of the, other side of the Straits. I would assume that those products are also vulnerable given the capacity and willingness demonstrated by Iran to this point in this conflict to attack port facilities in the region. All right, now there are a number of other differences between today and 1973. Most notably, in 1973, the Persian Gulf oil-producing nations represented about 37% of global production. Today, that number is about 26%. Same nations, same production, but there has been more development elsewhere in the world. At the time of the 1973 crisis, liquefied natural gas was not a thing. Today, about 26% of liquefied natural gas on the international market comes from Qatar. As I say, I would assume that this supply is under threat as a consequence of the military situation there, though it's not yet exactly clear what the situation will be. It's worth noting here that supply of liquefied natural gas is constrained not by production of natural gas, but by the port facilities required to process it. These facilities are very expensive and time-consuming to build, so it's very unlikely that other suppliers will be able to replicate this capacity in anything like the short term. And so we are left with a situation both in the oil and natural gas market. In the oil market, 20 million barrels a day, 15 of crude, 5 of refined products have been, are under threat of being subtracted from the global supply mixture. So to understand what the consequences of this disruption are likely to be, we're first going to look at the supply, where it's going, who consumes it. We're then going to look at the alternate sources of supply. So if 20 million barrels a day are subtracted from the Persian Gulf supply, where could they be supplemented from? We're then going to look at stockpiles and what potential forces exist to kind of paper over a short-term disruption. And then we're going to kind of conclude with some general comments. So 20 million barrels a day of crude and refined products from the Persian Gulf, where did they go? Well, unlike in 1973, these products are not primarily destined for the refineries on the American Gulf Coast. Only about 500,000 barrels a day are currently delivered via this route. The overwhelming majority of these exports go to the Asia-Pacific region. These are either refined products destined for nations without on-site refining capacity, or their crude products headed to places like China and India and Japan and Australia, who have their own local refineries that refine it on-site and distribute it as needed. About 1.4 million barrels a day are delivered from the Persian Gulf to Europe. They represent something like 25-30% of supply to the region. Very, very different dynamic as to the market as it currently stands, but this is a global market with a lot of international sea transport. A couple of interesting notes there. First of all, we have no idea how many tankers are trapped inside the Persian Gulf right at the moment, and therefore have been removed from the global shipping fleet. Second, any reorganization of this system is going to result in almost certainly a higher requirement for shipping. And so it's unclear whether significant adjustments to the supply chain can be managed by the current global tanker fleet. And certainly, even if they can, that global tanker fleet will have to be reorganized substantially in order to alter this flow in rapid response to an event of this kind. Now, when we start looking at potential sources to supplement demand, there are a couple of nations that have significant oil production capacity, which is currently not active. At the front of this list is Russia, which currently produces something like a million barrels a day, less than its maximum capacity for oil production, and so could readily increase production. However, there are political barriers to delivering this oil. Its port facilities in either the Black Sea or the European Arctic are not operating for export to the international market in quite the way you would expect. And there is a big problem in the transit of the oil to the Pacific coast, the port facilities, et cetera, there. So unless there is some substantial change in the diplomatic relationship between Europe, Ukraine, and Russia, it's quite unlikely that that million barrels a day is going to hit the international market. Equally, Russia could readily supply, could readily supplement a lot of the current liquefied natural gas exports from Qatar, but that's not going to happen because the natural gas supply lines necessary to do so run through Poland and Ukraine, neither of which are particularly inclined to cooperate right at the moment. So unless you saw a very substantial reorganization of the politics of Eastern Europe, you're not going to see that additional supply hit the market. Equally, Venezuela is another nation that has over 2 million barrels a day of potential additional capacity readily available. There are a couple of problems here. First of all, the infrastructure for extraction and delivery is old and has been inactive for, in some cases, a decade. And so there's significant work to retrofit it to get it into active production. The other issue is that Venezuelan crude tends to be very sulfur heavy. And so in order to replace Persian Gulf crude with Venezuelan crude, refineries have to reorganize their process to deal with the excess sulfur content. And so there's a whole process required to do that. Recall that investors in both at the refining level and at the extraction level are going to look at this situation and wonder if it's a bad financial decision to reorient their refining capacity or spin up additional production capacity, because at any moment they may expect that a diplomatic arrangement be made with Iran to restore export at much lower cost from the Persian Gulf, creating stranded investments. So it's unclear whether you're going to see crude from places like Venezuela appear in the global supply in order to soften the shock. Now, I went through and did an analysis of about 10 other oil-producing nations. The net of that analysis is there's another million or so barrels a day that could readily be turned on from existing oil-producing nations, and something on the order another 2 million barrels a day that is kind of suspect, whether it's Venezuela or Russia. And then there's another about 7 million barrels a day of oil production that if you're looking at the sort of 9 months to 2 year term, you could turn on with some investment and some change in how refining works. That compared with 20 million barrels a day that have been taken off the market. So less than half of the current Persian Gulf supply can be readily supplemented within like a 2 year window. So this is a pretty serious disruption in a very inelastic market. Okay, with all that said about the supply supplement side, let's talk about bridging the gap to new supply coming online. This is a situation which is much worse than you might expect. After the 1973 oil shock, the United States very famously created a very large strategic reserve of petroleum products. That reserve was intended to both supplement civilian and military fuel uses in the event of another major supply disruption. Couple of problems here. First of all, the oil consumption of the United States has radically escalated between 1980 and today. So the reserve doesn't go as far as it used to. Equally, over the last 10 years, and especially during the Biden administration, the strategic reserve was drawn down in order to moderate prices in the civilian market to ameliorate the effects of other inflationary policies that have been pursued in the United States in this period, right? This is domestic politics. And so you have a situation where there's something like 20 days worth of Persian Gulf production that exists in the strategic petroleum reserve in the United States. There are problems with getting it to market. One can only assume that a significant fraction of what's left in the reserve is earmarked for the military. If there's a disruption of this kind going on in Iran, given there's an active war in Russia, given there are frozen conflicts in East Asia, it seems very unlikely that the majority of the remaining reserve is going to be used to buffer the civilian market. Some of it may be used, but you're not looking at a substantial available buffer for this kind of disruption. Now, there are other significant strategic reserves that are designed to deal with this eventuality, most notably in East Asia, in places like Japan, the Philippines, and China. Now, unlike the United States, they do not publish publicly the contents of these strategic reserves. And so we're forced to rely on neocon think tanks and satellite images to guess at how much oil is contained in these reserves. The estimate is that in China, there's something like 100 days of their import equivalents in reserve. Similar story in the Philippines, Japan, a little bit more. But all of these reserves are subject to the same domestic political nonsense that's gone on with the American reserves. So it's very unclear exactly how much is currently in these strategic stockpiles, paired with the reality that a significant fraction of what's there will be reserved for military use, especially at a time of very significant geopolitical tension. And so we're left with the interesting question, how will this be resolved? Well, very likely the same way it was resolved last time, with restoration of productive capacity, either as a consequence of a military or diplomatic solution to the difficulty between the United States and Iran, by demand destruction as a result of price shocks, and as a result of the development and investment in alternative sources. Now, we talked about the replacement of capacity via alternative sources. The possibilities and the hazards of that approach. Demand destruction is an interesting thing. This market is a lot different than it was in 1973. A lot of the consumers are in Southeast Asia. It remains to be seen how sensitive these consumers are to severe shocks in price. But I suppose we're going to find out, because I don't see any other conclusion than if there is a durable disruption to supply in the Persian Gulf, that there will be a very severe price shock. You're looking at a shock to supply that is not as severe as the shock in the 70s and 80s, but substantially more severe than the shock associated with the Iraq war in 2003. So the Iraq war in 2003 saw something like 3x increase in oil prices. The situation in the 70s was more like 6-7x. We're looking at somewhere in between the two in terms of the severity of the shock to kind of get an order of magnitude for what's going on here, let alone the fact that we're in a situation where Europe is dependent for its electrical generation on liquefied natural gas imports that are likely to also be disrupted to a significant degree by this military action. We have a situation where it's very unclear what possible diplomatic or military solution there might be in a military climate where blockades are unprecedentedly easy to enforce. Very interesting, very difficult situation, one that a lot of people are very likely to suffer for if this goes on for any significant length of time. Thank you for your time and attention. I hope you learned something.
Canada originally was put together by two groups of people who didn't have much in common but didn't want to be American.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.